From the Witherspoon Concert Hall in Omaha's Joslyn Memorial, KIOS-FM proudly presents another program from the Utihalee Lecture Series. We'll hear a talk given by Charles Bierbauer, senior Washington correspondent for CNN. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Monday morning, November 11, 2002, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Utihalee Girls Village, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Dennis McCarville, Chief Executive Officer of Utihalee Girls Village.
Charles Bierbauer began his journalism career more than 30 years ago as a reporter for WKAP Radio in his hometown of Allentown, Pennsylvania. He started his overseas work as a reporter for Westinghouse Broadcasting Group in Philadelphia, where he was the foreign editor in London, the bureau chief in Bonn, and an Eastern European correspondent in Vienna. In 78, Mr. Bierbauer joined ABC News as network bureau chief and correspondent in Moscow and Bonn. From 85 to 96, Mr. Bierbauer was the host of CNN Newsmaker Saturday, a weekly report featuring an in-depth interview with leading newsmakers. Mr. Bierbauer worked for 12 years as an international journalist for CNN, where he covered all U.S.-Soviet summits, beginning with the Ford-Yeltsin summit in 1993. As CNN's senior White House correspondent for 9 years during the Reagan and Bush administration, Mr. Bierbauer spent more time in the White House than all presidents except Franklin Roosevelt. At that time, he traveled extensively with the presidents and was in 50 states as well as 30 foreign countries. Mr. Bierbauer, up until a year ago, was the senior White House correspondent and covered critical public policy issues, where he added to his level of expertise the Supreme Court, the federal government or budget, the tax and health care reform. Currently, he is the dean of the College of Mass Communication and Information Sciences at the University of South Carolina. He has received an Overseas Press Club Award, the gold and silver medal of the Houston Film Festival, and has shared several Cable Aces Awards at CNN. Mr. Bierbauer earned a bachelor's degree in journalism and Russian, and has a master's degree in journalism from Penn State. Penn State has not forgotten their distinguished alumnus, as they've honored him with their Distinguished Alumnus Award, as well as recognized him as an alumni fellow. With that, it's my pleasure to introduce to you Charles Bierbauer.
Thank you, Dennis, and thank you, Karen, and good morning. It is still morning, I think, here. I've asked Dennis if I could put in a plug for my college as well. We've got some major fundraising to do, too. But I'm trying to build a new building and looking at millions of dollars that it's going to take. I restrained from wearing my Penn State tie today. As Dennis kindly mentioned my roots, but I should mention that my roots have become intertwined with Nebraska roots. My wife is a native of Omaha, Nebraska, Suzanne Schaefer. Her family is still here. She's a graduate of Mercy High School and the University of Nebraska at Lincoln, and I'm sure wishes she could be here, and in fact will be here in about 2 weeks. We're coming back for Thanksgiving, so I'm just the advance trip here. Let me talk about several things this morning, and then I hope we will have plenty of time for questions. Just what happened in America last week? Well, in Nebraska, probably not so much that was terribly surprising. You reelected a governor and all three of your members of Congress, and probably no one accused Tom Osborne of running up the score. Let's look a bit more broadly. In South Carolina, where I now cast my vote, I've discovered some things don't change swiftly. We replaced an institution there, Senator Strom Thurmond, after nearly half a century in the U.S. Senate. On the other hand, some things do change swiftly. For the second election running, South Carolina denied re-election to a sitting governor. South Carolina put a Republican in the governor's office this time and a new Republican in Senator Thurmond's office, and it was a substantial sweep for the Republicans in South Carolina and broadly a major victory for Republicans and President Bush across the country. The trend lines for decades have been for a president's party to lose ground in the midterm elections. 2 years after he's elected, he tends to lose seats in Congress. This year, that did not happen. Why? Well, a combination of circumstances, a largely popular president, strong patriotic sentiments that linger from 9/11, now more than a year past, rumors of war. The president has been beating the drum to bring Iraq, and more specifically, Saddam Hussein, to account. A Republican campaign that capitalized on those themes and those sentiments and became, in essence, a vote of support for the president. A campaign built heavily on those themes and carried by the presidents to the battlegrounds, not of the Middle East, but of Florida, where his brother was running for re-election as governor, and Missouri, where a Democratic senator was vulnerable, and South Carolina, where a Democratic governor was vulnerable, and wherever around the country, the Republicans sensed Democratic vulnerability. The president putting his own reputation and political stake on the line here, not, of course, without an eye towards 2004. Would the Democrats have done any differently? Of course not. A night or two before Election Day, my wife answered the phone, gave an at first puzzled look, then sort of laughed and handed me the phone and said, "It's Bill Clinton." And so it was. Now, I know the president. I've spent some time with him, although I really didn't get a chance to say hello because when he finished speaking, the tape ran out and the phone hung up automatically. This is the terror of technology, you know. Which is worse, telemarketing or telepoliticking? Now, why else did the Republicans do so well in this election? In part because the Democrats were in disarray. What's new, you might ask? It's sometimes the nature of the Democrats to be that way. They had an incumbent senator in New Jersey, Bob Torricelli, destined for defeat, who resigned amid scandal, and the Democrats were fortunate to hang on to that seat. They had an incumbent in Minnesota, Paul Wellstone, who died in a plane crash. An interesting member of the Senate, an avowed liberal, and yet well-respected and well-liked, and an old war horse of the party, Walter Mondale, jumped into the race but was unable to hold that seat for the Democrats. Now, 2 years ago, a popular Democrat in another neighboring state of yours, Missouri, Mel Carnahan, died under similar circumstances, a plane crash, just before the election. And yet, Carnahan was elected and his wife Jean filled that seat, but Jean Carnahan, this time, was unable to win that seat in her own right. In the South, the Republicans continue to grow as the dominant party. They did lose a seat in Arkansas in the Senate, but in Georgia, the incumbent Democrat Max Cleland met an unexpected defeat, leaving cynics to gasp that Georgians had voted out a crippled war hero. In South Carolina, Governor Jim Hodges ran a weak and whiny campaign, sounded a Johnny One-Note theme about education, an important theme, but failed to convince voters that he had any handle on a budget disaster that threatened to do in what he had done for education. Now, I have vested interest in this because the South Carolina budget affects the amount of money I have to run the college. Hodges lost to a kind of a will-o'-the-wisp Republican who had come to Congress a few years ago, promising to serve no more than three terms, wasn't going to become a Washington fixture, and left Washington with little more to remember him by than the oddity that he had slept in his congressional office and showered in the House gym to save money because his family had remained in South Carolina. Mark Sanford may turn out to be a pretty decent governor for our state. At least we can say that he kept his promise not to overstay his welcome in Washington, and how often can we say a politician keeps his promise? So now what happens? I have no crystal ball. Certainly President Bush is strengthened for 2004. He has Republican control of both houses of Congress, although by narrow margins. There's ample speculation that now, perhaps, one or more justices of the U.S. Supreme Court will retire. Justice Rehnquist must be 77 or 78 by now. Justice O'Connor is in her early 70s, and this would give the president a chance to fill seats on the U.S. Supreme Court with relatively like-minded conservative justices. We'll have to see how that unfolds. It's still early in terms of thinking ahead to 2004, but I assure you every politician is. The elections are no sooner counted than they start running again. One thing that intrigues me about George W. Bush's performance is how it sometimes mirrors his father's and how it sometimes does not. Remember the swell of support for George Bush after the Gulf War, 91% in the popularity ratings? He was so popular that the strongest Democrats, Mario Cuomo, Sam Nunn, Bill Bradley, all declined to run against him in 1992, leaving the field open to Bill Clinton, who won the Democratic nomination and the presidency as George Bush Sr.'s popularity plunged on an economic downslide. So when the stock market plunged this year, it initially looked like Bush 2 could mirror Bush 1. Yet the economy has not pulled down George W. Bush's popularity. Granted, the president himself this year was not on the ballot, though certainly his prestige was. I think part of the answer is that while Bush, the father, was running for re-election, his war was over. But he was struggling to explain that the economy would turn around. And I remember also often he would say, this economy is turning, this economy is turning. And indeed it was, but it wasn't turning fast enough so that by November of 1992, Bill Clinton was able to be persuasive that it was the economy, stupid, as the sign in the campaign headquarters of the Democrats said, and the voters responded in that way. And the economy took off, more so in the Clinton administration. In contrast, Bush the son has concentrated his vocal efforts on beating the war drums against Saddam Hussein and avoiding the economic dilemma. There are two questions here I cannot readily answer. One is the effect of that piece of unfinished business, Osama bin Laden. The al-Qaeda leader may be dead, or he may be regrouping in some distant redoubt. I don't think the American electorate holds it against the president that Osama himself has not been unearthed or captured or brought to heel in some fashion. And it may indeed be that we'll never find out precisely. He could be buried under the rubble in Afghanistan. But I think the president gets credit for going after him and going after him forcefully. Yet what are we to make now of all the war rhetoric coming out of Washington? Well, fortunately, we now have a United Nations resolution calling for Iraq to comply with inspection procedures, and unless something has happened since I got out of the car half an hour ago and came in here and turned off the radio, we don't know what Saddam Hussein has done, but the expectations are that he will say, oh, but of course, come in. You may inspect. My palace is your palace. But we've gone through that routine before, and whether this will be a satisfactory process and the inspections which the UN is demanding under the threat of military action, primarily by the Americans with some small but not very widespread support from our allies. We may see an echo of what we saw in the aftermath of the Gulf War, that is to say, inspections that were inconclusive. We suspected, we thought, we believed, we knew what Saddam Hussein was doing with regard to possibly germ warfare and chemical warfare and, and nuclear warfare, his effort to get those kinds of weapons of mass destruction, as we call them. But it hasn't been a very successful decade of trying to figure out exactly and pin down Saddam Hussein. So why should we be any more likely, and why should we be any more confident that the inspections will be successful this year? Nonetheless, I think it's certainly a preferable alternative than going to war in a very difficult area of the world where it would be very hard, costly, both in terms of dollars and material, but especially in terms of people and lives, to try and govern, organize, get into the nation building in Iraq. The other observation one might make from the election results is that President Bush has an apparent immunity from the taint of the bad apples in the business barrel, the ones who have brought us the scandals at Enron and WorldCom, the chaos at AOL Time Warner, to mention only a few. I'm not suggesting the president, once a businessman himself, is in any way responsible for these, but he needs to continue to speak out and act against unscrupulous and illegal behavior wherever it undermines the welfare of the American public. I have a simple mantra for our college at the University of South Carolina. It is that every course we teach should be a writing course, and every course we teach should be an ethics course. I think that may apply more broadly than just to our College of Mass Communications and Information Studies. Perhaps every course we teach in any institution should be an ethics course. But I'm convinced that the media in particular have an obligation to bear in mind the enormous impact that the media have on our lives. A few days ago, I committed what might be considered an act of heresy for a journalist, though I think not. I told a friend of mine she did not have to talk to the press, that there were some things the press did not have to report, and that that would be all right. Until we moved to South Carolina in July, my family lived in Potomac, Maryland for 21 years. Potomac is very close to the area where a number of those sniper killings recently occurred. I know I had from time to time bought gas at the gas station where one of the first victims was gunned down. I used to play softball on a field near where the final victim, a bus driver, was killed. Nearly all the locations where the sniper had struck were familiar to me. Our friends and former neighbors in Maryland had been terrified and terrorized. Now, the friend who called is her school's PTA liaison to the school board. And when she called, she said a local reporter wanted to talk about the safety of the children at Potomac Elementary School, where my son was in fifth grade last year. Like many schools, Potomac has a number of those portable classrooms that dot the campus. And to get to them, the students must go outside the main building. And the reporter, quite reasonably, wanted to know if parents thought that that was safe. My friend said she felt it was better not to talk about something that might make her child and others targets. I agreed. At least I agreed that she did not have to talk to the press about it. No one really does. When we talk about the First Amendment, we talk about freedom of the press, freedom of speech, but inherent in freedom of speech is freedom not to speak, if you choose to. What struck me about the situation was that there is a delicate balance between the media and the public, between reasonable and even beneficial curiosity and invasive and even dangerous intrusion, between a right to know and a right to privacy. What is the proper role for the media these days? The events of 9/11 and the recent acts of the serial killers in Maryland and Virginia give me pause. How much do we want to know? What rights are we prepared to give up in the interest of security? Does the First Amendment get in the way of law enforcement? I'm not saying it does, but I think we should ask ourselves that question, and the answer may be, yes, the First Amendment does get in the way of law enforcement, and the response to that may be, so be it. The First Amendment is so treasured and valued to us. I carry a copy of the Constitution in my briefcase. I find it a useful reference from time to time. There is no question that the relationship of media and government is being tested by some of these uncertainties these days. You know, I spent a lot of my career covering the Cold War. I was a correspondent in Moscow and in Eastern Europe. And the Cold War ended, of course, when the Communist Empire collapsed. And the Cold War was easy. It was black and it was white. There were bad guys and good guys. And you worried about, did we have enough troops in Central Europe, in Germany, to keep the Russians and the Warsaw Pact from coming through the Fulda Gap and undermining the democratic institutions of Western Europe? After the collapse of communism in Europe, it wasn't black and white anymore. It was very gray. Who were the good guys? Were the Poles and the Romanians and the Hungarians now good guys? I mean, they longed for democracy. Even many Russians longed for democracy. Most Russians longed for democracy. And the world became an area in which we really had to interpret the shades of gray and the acts of terrorism that we are seeing and the diverse and disparate issues that have come to the fore in the wake of the end of the Cold War have made it a much more difficult place to live in and to be a journalist in. It's harder to figure all this stuff out and to be a diplomat in and to be a statesman. And so we are being tested by these uncertainties. We heard the Montgomery County, Maryland police chief vent at the media one day for reporting that a tarot card with a message had been found at the scene of one of the shootings. If the media want to solve the crimes, Chief Moose said, fine, I've got other things to do. Not too many days later, the chief was calling on the media to relay a message to the sniper. And in the end, it was when officials let the press know what kind of car they were looking for, and it wasn't a white van, as it turns out. It was sort of a dingy blue sedan. But it was when they let the press know what kind of car they were looking for and what the license plate was that a truck driver spotted that car at a Maryland rest stop, called the police, not only called the police, but while he was waiting for them to come, maneuvered his truck to block the exit from the rest stop. Did the media serve the public interest? You bet they did. On the other hand, at one point during the sniper siege, I heard Wolf Blitzer, my former colleague at CNN, touting a CNN viewer poll. Here was the poll. Should the police release the text of the sniper's letter to the public? Call now and cast your opinion. What was that all about? A new TV reality show? If we don't like the job the cops are doing, do we get to vote one of them off the force? Instant polls belong nowhere in crime fighting. And they really don't belong much of anywhere in news reporting. They're a device of bored television producers who want to add another graphic to the clutter that's already filling up our television screens, another place to put the station's logo on it. Or am I just a generation behind? Or do you too see a lot of chaff and clutter that must be waded through to get to the news? Not just on television, but in the newspapers too. I suppose it's a wonderful demonstration of what technology allows us to do when we can look at a television screen and get the weather, the stock report, the ball scores, the news, and the latest gossip from Hollywood all at once. But just because we can, should we? This is the ethical question I want all of my journalism students and public relations students and advertising students and information studies students to address every day. Should we, for example, air pictures, put pictures on television or in the newspaper of people jumping from the top floors of the World Trade Center simply because we have those pictures? Perhaps we should, to demonstrate the utter hopelessness of innocent people who died as a result of terrorism. Should we show pictures of the death of Daniel Pearl, the Wall Street Journal correspondent who was kidnapped in Pakistan Should we show them because the gruesomeness of Pearl being beheaded reveals the utter lawlessness of terrorists? Should we identify convicted sex offenders who have served their sentences but may be living in our neighborhoods so we will know where our children may not be safe? It's a question not just for journalists, but for our courts and for ourselves. If a depressed and despairing soul pours gasoline over himself in the town square and calls the local television station to send a camera crew over, and this has happened, do we go? Do we turn on the cameras? Or does the cameraman take himself out of the impersonal role behind the camera and try to stop this act of self-immolation? Do we report the names of minors accused of crime? Do we pursue the politicians engaged in extramarital behavior? More questions we should be asking ourselves, not just as journalists, but how we feel about them as the public. Questions to ask so that we may do a better job representing the interests of the people who watch the newscasts and read the newspapers. In Moscow, a few days ago, when the hostages were being held in that theater by Chechen rebels, some of the hostages communicated with a local radio station by cell phone. And the radio station put the hostages on the air and put the terrorists on the air, too. Talk to the Chechen terrorists who were holding those hostages. Well, it's an interesting choice. It's an interesting exercise. And the editor-in-chief of that radio station felt that this would better give people an understanding of why this was happening and why the government may need to take drastic action. But in the wake of that drastic action and terrible action, the gassing that resulted in more than 100 deaths of the hostages, not to mention all the terrorists, the Russian government has responded with restrictions on reporting anti-terrorist measures. And the editor sadly says that the government is fighting the journalists instead of the terrorists. Now you may ask, what can I do about this? I'm just a consumer. I just watch CNN and watch Fox News and listen to Tom and Peter and Dan and read the papers. And there are things you can do if you're not happy about it. You can vote with your remote. You can change channels. You turn it off. You can write. You can phone. You can email. And you can let the publishers and the editors and the station managers know when they're doing a good job and when you don't think they are. One of the intriguing things over a continuum is what I consider a false premise under which most television stations operate, and that is the notion that the only people they really want to appeal to are between 18 and 45 because they've got all the money. Now, I've got a lot of gray in my beard, and I see a few gray hair out in the audience here. And I don't know where they get this notion completely. Maybe it's because they like the kind of ads that appeal to macho young men and active young women. But demographics tell us that folks of a certain age, my age and beyond, are reasonably well off and are good consumers and probably have a better record of voting than most any demographic age group. So I think if you've got problems with the media, they need to hear from you. And I suspect if they hear from enough of you, they will be responsive. Having said all that, I still think journalism education is very important because we're not going to live without journalists and we're not going to live without the media, not in a very democratic society. You know the words of Thomas Jefferson where he was asked if he would rather have a nation where there was a government and no journalists, or one where there were journalists and no government, and he responded, I will take the latter, because that is where the democracy lies. So I've shifted my role here, and I've become a journalism educator. Now, I didn't wake up on a Tuesday morning and say, hey, I think it'd really be neat to be the dean of a college, although it is kind of neat. I had been teaching courses for Penn State and Washington for some years. I've been on several university advisory boards. I taught a course up at the University of Michigan last spring, and I teach the relationship of media and government. And when I was a practicing journalist, I used to say, well, I wasn't ready to give up my job to some eager 25-year-old who had no experience of the world but looked pretty good on television. Now my objective is to make sure that that 25-year-old not only looks pretty good on television, in fact, I don't care how pretty they are, but that they have some knowledge that they bring with them, and that 25-year-old is ready to take over that job. And I tell them, you don't need a journalism degree to be a journalist. I mean, it's not like doctors and lawyers where you have to cross some threshold. You walk into the newsroom and you say, I'm a journalist. And who's to dispute you if you can write and you're smart and you're intelligent? And I tell my students that they need to bring more than just that journalism sheepskin with them, because there are thousands of these kids across the country, and I guess I can call them kids on a relative basis. Thousands of young people with journalism degrees, more than there are jobs for them to fill. We've got 1,400 students in our college at the University of South Carolina. University of Nebraska at Lincoln has 1,100 students in the College of Journalism and Mass Communications. I was down there this morning to see my friend Will Norton, who's the dean down there. And the College of Communications at Penn State has 3,000 students in it. Now, that includes advertising and public relations and, in their case, communication studies, whatever that may be, and also a film program. But this is a huge enterprise across the country. There are tens of thousands of people who want to be journalists or ad writers or public relations specialists, and an awful lot of them want to sit on television and tell you what's going on. And I say, bring something else to the table. Don't tell me you've got a journalism degree. Tell me you speak three languages. Tell me you were in the Peace Corps. Tell me you've also got a law degree. Tell me you've volunteered in your neighborhood and built houses in the Jimmy Carter's Habitat for Humanity project. Bring something else to the tables. Tell me you know something. And also tell me that you know how to write about it. At the University of South Carolina tomorrow, we will unveil a new installation that we call Newsplex. It's a multimedia newsroom of the future. I won't call it the newsroom of the future because I don't know what the newsroom of the future is, but this is a newsroom of the future. It's one way of looking at how we will gather and how we will disseminate news to you and the rest of America and the world. It's a multimedia newsroom. What does that mean? It's a place where we can explore the possibilities of gathering and reporting the news or carrying out a public relations effort or ad campaign on a variety of media all at once. This is the way of the media today. When I was at CNN, I did not just report for television. There was radio and the internet and the CNN Newswire. And I would be doing my television report, and the producer in my ear would say, when you're done, don't forget to file radio. Oh, and at 4 o'clock, the internet would like you to do a chat. Well, now that's not convergent. That's sort of coincidental news media. We're all in the same place, but they weren't thinking as much as a whole of how they could do that kind of reporting. And that's what we want to do in Newsplex, because the trend is that every newspaper has a website. Every television station has a website. If the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, relaxes restrictions on cross-ownership, which means you can't own the TV and the newspaper in the same market, you can own TV in one market and newspapers in the other market, as many publishing and media companies do, you will see, if these restrictions are relaxed, the Omaha World Herald says, no, we might as well buy a TV station here, too. We can get some economies of scale. Much of this is being done across the country. If you go into the newsroom of the Chicago Tribune, you'll see a big TV studio right in the middle of the newsroom. And they use the news reporters to report on the local television stations. And Tampa Tribune does the same thing. It's called convergence, and it's really where we're going to be headed so that you will get your news not just in the newspaper and broadcast on the internet, wireless communications. Your cell phone goes off, and there's the ball scores, Nebraska 45, Kansas 7. And you say, yes. Thank goodness for that wireless communication. I really needed to know that right now. But what we're doing is trying to figure out how to make this work. So Newsplex is a $2 million laboratory, a newsroom to train journalists to use these converging media and to teach our students the changing nature of the business that they aspire to and to research the effectiveness of multimedia. We don't see it as a panacea, but it is a direction that we're going to go in an ever-changing scene, and I suspect you will be exposed to things we haven't even thought about yet, some kind of communication unknown to us, a little chip behind your ear, perhaps, and it'll all come instantaneously, and we haven't gotten into telepathic journalism yet, but we'll try. We want to make sure, in short, that the technology is not driving us. When I worked in Philadelphia at a TV station there 25 years ago, it was a transitional time, just as every time is a little bit transitional, but we were going from film to videotape. Now, film was had a nice advantage. You'd go out, you'd shoot the story on film, you had to bring the film back to the laboratory, you had to put it in the soup, as we would say, and it took about 90 minutes until the film was processed, and you could look at it, so you could go to lunch, you could read the newspaper, you could put your feet on the desk and take a nap. You had some time to kill. Videotape doesn't allow you to do that. Videotape is instantaneous. It's on tape. We can broadcast it right away, and sometimes we do, and sometimes perhaps we should not. But it's right there, and we can use it. And then we got our first microwave relay truck, which meant you've seen these trucks running around Omaha. It looks like a van. It's got 6 or 3 or 9 or 12 emblazoned on the side. And I had a news director who once said, when you're out shooting the story, make sure you get the truck in the picture at some point. And it's got this big, tall mast that goes up hydraulically, and if you turn it in the right direction, you beam it back to the studio. So you don't have to go back with your videotape. You can be live anywhere. Nowadays, you see on CNN people using what they call a, what do they call it, a satellite telephone. It'll fit in about the size of a good-sized briefcase, but you can broadcast from the mountains of Afghanistan, as we have, with just this briefcase-sized piece of equipment. But as often as not in the news meetings, in the editorial meetings at KYW in Philadelphia, when we had this new truck, we said, well, what are we going to do with it? We've got this wonderful new toy, and we're not quite sure how to use it. And it seemed that there were many days when the solution was, well, we'll put it outside the studio with the weatherman, because the weather's outside. And so you'd see this truck sitting out in front of the studio and the weatherman doing live reports from the street. You have to grow with the technology, and the technology is often ahead of us. But what we want to make sure is that the technology is not driving us editorially, but liberating us. That is, liberating us to do a better job, but always one in which we ask ourselves, are we doing this because we can or because we should? Thank you very much. I appreciate your attention. I would be happy to take questions if you have them. I'm not sure exactly how much time we have. I think there are people with microphones, that liberating technology that means you don't have to get out of your seat, but the microphone will come to you. And I can't see very well because the lights are in my eyes, so if the folks down on the floor with the microphones, I see a lady waving her hand. I think it's a lady in the back waving her hands.
I have a question.
Please.
When CNN has 24-hour news, they tend to repeat and repeat and repeat. What can they do to make it more meaningful and not bring in these correspondents from the general public who really don't have too much to say sometimes?
The ubiquitous talking head, as we call them. Here's the thing about 24-hour news. When I left ABC News, which had a half-an-hour evening newscast, and joined CNN in its first year on the air, and thought, wow, 24 hours of news, as much time as you would ever want. Well, that's not quite the way it works. What it is not 24 hours of news, but 24 hours each individual. And each of those is sort of a separate newscast. Excuse me. And so the producer of each newscast, the 11 o'clock show, the 12 o'clock show, the 1 o'clock show, wants the big story on his or her newscast. And so you start to get some replication. You start to get some repetition. If the big story is what will Saddam Hussein do, the UN has voted this resolution, each of those hours is probably going to start with the same story until some other big story comes along to replace it. Moreover, I suspect, unless you are an absolutely dedicated viewer, you don't watch it 24 hours a day. But you tune in and you tune out. You're in the kitchen making breakfast and you might have it on, or you might be watching Katie Couric. Or it's after dinner and you're sitting down reading the newspaper or just relaxing and you got it on. But you have it on sporadically at different times of day. I keep the television on in my office behind me, out of sight. I want to hear it, but I don't want to watch it until something catches my ear, and then I'll turn to see what might be on the air. And we all watch these things in different fashion. So you're going to have repetition, but the story keeps advancing, and from hour to hour, the terminology we use is, how do you advance the story? What's new? Tell me what's new. There were times when I was at the White House where they'd say, we want you on at 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, and 5 o'clock, and I'd say, well, when am I supposed to do my reporting? Well, just tell us what you told us the last hour. And that's not a very good system. Now, the other thing, the question about the talking heads. Most of them, you'll notice, are identified as former prosecuting attorney, former attorney general, former this, former that. These are the people who are available often. But you do get to the officials, and the officials are important. And it's also valuable to get perspective from someone who has been there. If you're talking about how are we going to prosecute these two men who conducted this reign of terror in Maryland and Virginia, maybe a former prosecuting attorney can give you useful information. Here's the problem. Television, I like to describe, is a little bit like Cyclops, this Greek mythological giant, except this one's not mythological, with one eye in the center of its forehead. And when it gets that eye focused. It is riveted. It's got lousy peripheral vision. It doesn't see what's going on over here, but it will see what is there. And because it's a giant, it's sort of lumbering, although at times it could be very quick and responsive. But once you commit your resources in television, and resources are expensive and not always easy to move, not everything is contained in that one briefcase, so you've got your people sitting outside the Montgomery County Courthouse in Montgomery County, Maryland, because of this sniper siege that we're going through, and first you send one reporter out there and he starts doing live reports, and then you say, hey, this is a really big story. Let's send the anchor out. So you put the anchor out there, and the anchor has to have a chair to sit in. And somebody says, hey, can we get some food out here? So they have to get catering involved in it. And it's raining. Can we get a little tent over the anchor here so the anchor doesn't get wet? Everybody else is getting wet. And you start to see how an army moves, and what the army calls, it's Veterans Day, the tooth-to-tail ratio. You've got this big, long tail to get one person on the air, and you get committed, and so you keep focusing on that story. And it's a big story. It's an important story. I'm not demeaning it, but this is how television operates. And you say, you know, nothing is really happening out here, and the chief said he won't have any more information until 5 o'clock, and that's 3 hours away. Should we be talking about something else in the interval? No, if you do that, people will change the channel. They'll go to Fox. We don't want them to do that. So you get a couple former prosecuting attorneys in here, and we'll talk to them, and we'll fill the time until something else happens. And that's what you get into in the way of television production. I would urge you to take a walk and come back and see what they have to say a little bit later. But I wanted you to understand why that happens. It is often very much a logistical and an attempt to maintain the audience. Don't let them go away because something might happen here, and you sort of keep the anticipation up. Is that good? No, not always. But that's the mindset. Now, that was a long answer. I'll try and be a little more brief for the next question. What was that? What was that old line from Radio Days? I have a lady in the balcony, but
yes, I wanted to know how difficult is it getting through security at the airports now with all of your equipment that you have to take?
I don't have any equipment to carry with me anymore. Fortunately, I can travel with a briefcase. I had to take my shoes off in South Carolina when I came up here. I won't wear those shoes in airports anymore. It's complicated, but it's not the worst thing that can happen to you. Marvin Kalb, a name you may remember from NBC and CBS days, was down in South Carolina a couple of weeks ago in the middle of this terror siege in Washington. He said it was very eerie going to the airport, National Airport in Washington, because no one was checking baggage curbside. Everyone was getting out of the cab, getting out of the car, and dashing into the terminal, not wanting to be outside. That's the kind of terror that the sniper created. And if you look at terrorism broadly, that's the kind of concern you have. We had this fellow get on a plane in, I think it was London, with explosives in his shoes. Well, I don't want to sit next to somebody with explosives in his shoes. I don't want to sit next to somebody with a box cutter or a concealed weapon. And so I'm not troubled by security at airports. You just get there a little bit earlier. Let me take you back 30 years. 1972, the Munich Olympics. And as you probably recall, this was where the Black September Palestinian terrorists vaulted a fence, invaded the Israeli quarters in the Olympic Village, in the Athletes' Village, killed a couple of them outright and held siege there for nearly 24 hours before they were put on a bus and taken to an airport where just a horrible firefight occurred and all the athletes' hostages were killed. A German policeman was killed and some of the terrorists too. And that really was the first time, to my thinking, that people said, you know, you're not safe anywhere. There is always that possibility. Now, we'd seen planes hijacked to Cuba, but what? You know, the planes got hijacked to Cuba. The guy got off. The Cubans arrested him, sent the plane back. Not a lot of trouble. Inconvenience, but. And so that kind of terrorism was sort of distant, and it didn't occur here. And, yeah, people blew themselves up in Sri Lanka, there were horrible tolls of life in some of those events. But when it started to happen at a place where everybody thought, oh, this is neat, the Olympics, this is fun, and the Germans were so intent on having the happy games that they actually relaxed to some degree in their security because they didn't want it to look like Munich in 1936 when the Nazis were running the place. And so they became vulnerable. And after that, as I was living in Germany and as I was covering these games, you realize that a security measure may be an inconvenience, but it was for your benefit. And so it didn't trouble me seeing German border guards at the airport carrying machine guns, and it didn't trouble me to have to go through these magnetometers because I saw the purpose of it. Even if it was only a deterrent, if you said, oh, I know how to get through those things with plastic weapons, and certainly that has happened. So that's what you do. You put up with it. Is it an inconvenience for television people with 1,000 pounds of gear? Uh-huh. But it's an inconvenience for everyone. But I think there is a greater good principle invoked here, and I'm quite willing to go through it, and I'm quite pleased that the government has said, we're going to make sure that these security firms are doing the best job, even if we have to hire them, as they have done, because some of it was lax. Do we have time for One more question. I see you.
I was just
George Bush used to always say, it's the last question that gets you in trouble.
I'm just curious, since you're the dean of the journalism school, is there a special class they have to teach these reporters to stick a microphone in someone's face and say, how do you feel?
That's why I want every class to be an ethics class. One of the things that, probably the thing about my job that I liked least was exactly what you just described. And when I worked in Philadelphia, and I worked on a night shift for a while, and you know, between the 6 o'clock news and the 11 o'clock news, 10 o'clock here, you're in a different time zone, what happens? Fires in North Philly, murders in South Philly, car wrecks in Camden. Yeah, nothing much good happens between 5 o'clock and 11 o'clock at night. And the 11 o'clock news wants to have something fresh. It doesn't want to look just like the newscast you saw 5 hours earlier. So there is this great tendency to, as we say, if it bleeds, it leads. If it's bent, broken, burned, battered, you put it on the evening news. And with that territory comes this presumption that you have to stick the microphone in someone's face and say, how does it feel? And so if you're doing these stories, I know this, and I've had exactly this conversation with some other people on my faculty who quite coincidentally describe the same feeling, that you go up there and you say, well, look, there's been this tragedy, and what do we know? Do we know anything about this person? Can we get some sense from his family? And you knock on the door, and the cameraman's there, and you sort of knock, and you say, nobody home. Whew. So I don't have to put the microphone in that person's face and say, how do you feel, Mrs. Brown? Your son's dead. How do you feel, Mr. Smith? Your wife's been in an accident. How could you feel? But there's another side to that. Have you ever noticed how willing many people are to talk? There is a catharsis for the person on the other side. Now, you can absolutely say, I can't talk. Or if you're in that kind of a circumstance, it's always great to have a neighbor or someone who can say, leave her alone. She's not talking to anyone. Or don't disturb the family. And I think most reporters would respect that with a sigh of relief. And yet, there are people who want to say, Johnny was a good boy. I cannot imagine him doing that sort of thing. Or even to say, she was terribly troubled. This is a sad thing, but I want people to know why this happened so that it won't happen in your family. People want to explain that. Maybe it's a little bit of this Andy Warholism that says you all get 15 minutes of fame. But I think it's just more a deep-set, heartfelt pouring out that somebody wants to say something preferably good about someone who has just gone through a terrible experience. And so the media are torn. Is there some lesson that might be learned here? Is there some message that you can pass on to the rest of your audience that says, you know, I can understand that, and maybe I can prevent it happening again? I think that's what they want to say. But it's a terrible feeling to have to go up to someone with that microphone and say, how do you feel? There are other ways to do it. You can go to the neighbors and say, do you think they'd have anything you want to say? And I think we need to be much more feeling about it. And we try and keep ourselves out of the story. When you become part of the story, when the journalist becomes part of the story changes, and it usually doesn't change for the better. You contort it, you distort it, you confuse it, if nothing else. So I like to keep journalists as observers and reporters, not part of the story. Well, that's not a terribly uplifting note to end on. I do thank you very much. It's a delight to be in Omaha before the snow flies. And I'm going to get out of town tonight before I'll be back for Thanksgiving and the turkey and the snow and everything else. Thank you.
You've been listening to a program from the Utah-Holly Lecture Series. We've heard a talk by Charles Bierbauer, Senior Washington Correspondent for CNN. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Monday morning, November 11, 2002, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Keith Christie for his help in the recording of this program. Special thanks also to Jerry Ann Cowan, Publicity Chairman for the Utah-Holly Lecture Series, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Audio cassette copies of this program are available for $15. Send a check or money order to Utah-Holly Girls Village, care of Tracy Wells, 3017 Mormon Street, Omaha, Nebraska, 68112-2205. All proceeds from the sale of tapes will go to benefit the Utah-Holly Girls Village. Please allow 2 to 3 weeks for delivery. The next lecture in the series will be Monday morning, April 14th at 11 o'clock. The guest speaker will be Deborah Sherwood, who will share her extensive knowledge of the nation's first families. If you'd like to attend this or other lectures in the series, call the Utah-Holly Girls Village at 453-0803. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.